Okay, good afternoon. Where is everybody? Is it that nice outside?
Oh, they all drop.
All right, well, you had a test last time. It's graded and your scores are up on Blackboard. I didn't let the lecturer, the lab instructor have your test because it's still top secret, okay? So next week you'll be able to look at your Scantron and the tests and see what was going on with everything. Unless you want to see me during office hours, maybe sometime. Nah, I still don't want to do it this week, okay? So next week you can check it out. I don't recall what the grades were like. I think there were, a bunch of really nice, spectacular grades and some okay grades, and I would guess some people did a lot better this test compared to previous tests, so very nice. I know you have to put time in order to make that happen. That just doesn't happen automatically. And I guess that's all I got to say about the test, okay, because I can't quite remember what the grade distribution was with it. All right, well, we had just started talking about hearing last time, so we're going to finish up hearing and equilibrium senses and then go on to vision, and I think that will be it for this particular chapter. So the senses of equilibrium and hearing involve the ear. And so does that make these senses a general sense or a special sense, and why? Because they're special because they're just in two locations in your body, right? You can't hear with any other part of your body, just your ears. So that's a special sense. General means that you have those receptors all over your body. All right, so the ear consists of three main parts, the outer ear, the middle ear, and the inner ear. And I think that's where we were talking last time. So I'm not going to talk much about the outer ear or middle ear anymore. We're going to start talking about the inner ear because this is where the receptor organs and the receptor cells for equilibrium and hearing are located. And so let's start, what should we start with? Let's start with a thing that looks like a snail. That's called the cochlea. Right, you see it on this slide right here? I don't have a marker. Here it is. Let me get my pointer options working. All right. So here is the cochlea. And this is a compressed view. We're looking kind of at a lateral projection, maybe a little bit of a frontal projection. And the cochlea is actually like a musical instrument that's inside your head. And I could ask you what musical instrument it reminds you of, but I think I'm going to have to tell you because it's not really obvious. It's really a piano, okay, a piano keyboard. So when you have a piano keyboard, what does it look like? So if I'm standing in front of a piano, here's the keyboard, it has what? A bunch of keys, right? From left to right, and you push on a key and it makes a note, you push on another key, it makes a note. And what's the difference in the notes from one side of the piano to the other? What's happening? Yeah, one is a lower frequency, a deeper tone, and the other end of the piano, it's a different frequency, it's a higher tone, higher pitch, right? And the way that we talk about pitch in science is frequency. So low notes are low frequency, and high notes are high frequency. So if we look at a piano keyboard, here's a keyboard, just like this, with all the notes in there, right? When you push this key over here, there's a little hammer that hits something. What does it hit inside the piano? It hits a string, right? And if you look at a really nice piano like that, this is kind of what the strings look like. Over here, I think I have it laid out correctly, the strings are what compared to on the other end? Okay, these are long and thick, right? So these vibrate at a low frequency. These over here are really short and thin. They vibrate at a higher frequency, and that sounds like a higher pitch, right? And the keys in the middle have what? Kind of an intermediate length and thickness. So just by the structure, the physical structure of something determines what frequency it likes to vibrate at. And what it vibrates at is the sound that it puts into the air. Furthermore, if we took, for instance, like a loudspeaker with a low frequency, guess what part of the piano would just automatically start vibrating? would be one of the long thick strings. And if we took a loudspeaker and put in a high frequency note, then these strings over here would start to vibrate, right? So energy can jump in and out of these strings based on what their length and thickness is. So just the structure of the strings determines the frequency at which they vibrate. All right, so now let's look at that cochlea. So here is the cochlea, and it looks like a snail, and I said that it's really a piano. How would you have to get that cochlea to look like a piano? All you have to do is just unwind it, right? So that's very easy to do. So let's unwind the cochlea so it's straight like that. So how come the cochlea looks like a snail and not just straight? Well, because we'd look really silly with these pianos sticking out of our ears like that, right? So it's been rolled up so that it fits inside. What bone does it fit inside of? It's in the petrous region of what bone? The temporal bone. Yeah, it's within the temporal bone. So anytime your biology needs something big to fit it in a small space, it is what? It's convoluted. It's folded or it's rolled up or something of that nature. Okay, so we unroll the cochlea. This is what it looks like from the side. But let's look down from the top. Okay, let's look down from the top. And what it looks like from the top, right, it looks like this. So this end over here, which corresponds to this area right in here, right after we unrolled it, this is what we call the helicotrema. Helicotrema. All right, and this end over here, okay, is connected up to the oval window. What else has the oval window attached to it? This is from anatomy. Remember, we have the three auditory ossicles, right? The incus, valleus, and stapes, and the stapes is actually attached to the oval window, and the base of the stapes right there is oval in shape, so it's really easy to see that this is the oval window right here. That's what injects vibrations into the cochlea. All right, so the oval window is going to be right here. So sound enters this part. All right, so what part, what frequency is this going to vibrate at, this part of the cochlea? This is the really short one, and here's the long one. So this is high frequency. I'm just going to abbreviate that HF, high frequency. And then down over here is going to be low frequencies. And in between are mid-range frequencies, just like a piano, okay? So just by the shape of the cochlea determines what part is going to be excited by the sound energy by frequency. Okay, so that's the cochlea. But inside the cochlea, we've got something else. All right, we've got a center area right here. So this area right here that sound comes in on is underwater. There's fluid in here. Does anybody remember what this fluid is? This is endolymph. Okay, endolymph. You have a nice picture in your book, which I don't have a picture of. Here is endolymph. Over here as well. Oh, sorry. Okay, perilymph. Perilymph, and then in this tube over here we have endolymph. So sound comes in and it's going to cross this area that has endolymph depending on the frequency. High frequencies are going to come over here, right, and then exit. Low frequencies will go all the way down to the helicotrema and then cross over and then make its way out of the cochlea. So here is the oval window. Guess what window is right here? That's the round window. Because if energy comes into the cochlea and it's not allowed to escape, guess what's going to happen to the cochlea? It's going to break. It's going to blow up. Right? So that energy has to be released, and it's this round window that can vibrate back and forth, releasing that energy. Okay. So can you remember these chambers? This is the scala, vestibuli, and this is the scala tympani. All right, and this one here is just what we call the cochlear duct, right up over here. All right, so how is it, so when you hear something on your cerebral cortex, what's happening in your cerebral cortex that relates to sound in the environment? What's happening to the cerebral cortex? What's going on in the cerebral cortex? What's the language? Yeah, what's the language of the cerebral cortex? How does the cerebral cortex know that anything is going on? And how does the cerebral cortex know that the intensity is changing? The cerebral cortex is experiencing, what are these little guys? These are action potentials, okay? Sorry for the diagram. Action potential. And what can you tell me about these action potentials? They're all identical, right? And if the intensity of sound increases, how would these action potentials change? What would it look like? Yeah, they get all bunched up, right? It just the frequency would increase, but they would all look the same. All right, so it's the job of this area right here to change sound into what? Action potentials. Because that's what your brain understands, action potentials. So how does your ear change sound energy into action potentials or electrical information? All right, so we say that each region of this area right here is sensitive to a particular frequency. So let's look at this region right here. Within this region right here, there is something called the organ of Corti. Okay, so the organ of Corti is right in here. So I'm going to have to draw what the organ of Corti really looks like. So let's make a nice, like a transverse cut of the cochlea and look at the organ of Corti. So here it is. So here is the scala vestibuli here. Here is the scala tympani down over here. And then, all right, we have a membrane coming down like this. And here is the, what do we call this? This is the, what is this tube right here called? It will come back to me in a second. Close. All right, so here's a cell. Here's a cell. And here's a cell. And so here, this right here is what we call the tectorial membrane. And when sound goes across, oh, I had that name of that tube for a second. Cochlear duct. Okay, cochlear duct. As sound goes across, right, and it depends on how thick the cochlea is at that region, right? The lower the frequency, the more the wave is going to penetrate. So sound is going to move across. And when it moves across, guess what happens to this tectorial membrane? It's going to vibrate. Yeah, it's going to vibrate up and down. Well, here are some cells that have projections that attach to the tectorial membrane. And as the tectorial membrane, right, vibrates, it bends these cilia on these cells. These cells then start action potentials that go to the brain as a result of that. So when these hair cells bend, right, it opens up sodium channels in the cell. So sodium can enter, and when sodium enters the cell, what happens to the resting membrane potential of this cell? It depolarizes, that's a stimulus. That causes an action potential on these nerves that go to the auditory cortex, which is in the temporal lobe. Okay, so specific cells will depolarize based on the frequency because of the shape of the cochlea right here. All right, the other thing that you should know, the name of these cells right here. Because they have these little hairs sticking out of them, they're not really hairs like what we have on our head, right? They're really cilia. We call these, nonetheless, hair cells. All right, so the hair cells in the organ of Corti send action potentials to the brain. As the tectorial membrane vibrates with greater amplitude, not frequency, not faster or slower, but greater amplitude, what can you tell me about action potentials going to the brain? So here is a set of action potentials going to the brain. Here's another set. This tectorial membrane will vibrate only at one particular frequency, but it can vibrate a little bit, or it can vibrate a lot, depending on the intensity of the sound. If the sound is very loud, the tectorial membrane is going to vibrate a lot. What will the action potentials look like? More. As the membrane vibrates weakly, there will be less action potentials going to the brain. But remember, the vibration of this tectorial membrane is fixed, depending on exactly where it is within the cochlear duct. As you get out the helicotrema, it's lower frequency. Okay, so I could ask you, for instance, what's the name of the bony labyrinth for the sense of hearing? Where do we have the bony structure in which the apparatus for hearing is located? It's going to be in the petrous region of the temporal bone, and it is this thing right here. This is the cochlea. So the cochlea is the bony labyrinth. Furthermore, I could ask you, what's the name of the organ that gives you the perception of sound? The organ is going to be where? Inside the cochlea. What's the organ inside the cochlea? Organ of Corti. And then I could ask you specifically, what's the receptor cell that actually transduces sound energy into action potentials? That's the hair cells. And I could say, are you kidding me? A hair cell? And you're going to say, well, yeah, they're not really hairs. They're really cilia that cause depolarization. Right? They're special receptor cells. Okay. That's in this region of the ear right here. All right. We got two other senses. Well, I tell you what, before we leave hearing, how does that sound get into the cochlea? Well, it's got to be focused by the auricle into the external auditory meatus. It's got to vibrate the tympanic membrane back and forth. So it's got to move the auditory ossicles back and forth, which then the stapes pressurizes the fluid, right, by the oval window. So what part of the ear is necessary for hearing? Is it the outer ear, the middle ear, or the inner ear in order for you to hear something? What part is necessary? You know what? Absolutely everyone, right? Every single part of the ear is necessary for hearing. The outer, the middle, as well as the inner is necessary for hearing. It seems like a silly question since we're talking about the ear, but let's talk about two other senses in the ear. What are some other senses? They have to do with equilibrium, and there's two kinds of equilibrium. There is static, and I'm just going to abbreviate equilibrium as EQ, and then there is kinetic. Kinetic equilibrium. And you have this sense, or these senses, in your inner ear. Let's talk about static equilibrium first. Okay, so here we have the cochlea. What did we say the cochlea was important for? Cochlea is important for? Yeah, I can't quite hear you. It's for hearing, right? All right. And then there's this part. This part right here is what we call the vestibule. And then another part contains these little canals right here. We call these semicircular canals. So semicircular canals. So what we're going to look at next is the vestibule. So the vestibule, again, is a bony structure. And the semicircular canals are bony structures. And we're not so interested in the bony structure. We're more interested in what's going on inside there, just like we're more interested in the organ of Corti, for instance, than the cochlea. All right, so let's see if I can find some of these pictures. Okay, this is all really nice, good. All right, so here we have, right, the bony labyrinth inside the ear. And here you can see the cochlea. And notice that can you tell that this is actually the thick region right here? It's the wide region. It's hard to tell from this perspective. And this is the thin region, so this is what's going to respond to low frequencies. This is what's going to respond to high frequencies. All right, well, let's shift our attention to not hearing, but equilibrium. And in particular, the kind of equilibrium that is sensitive to linear acceleration. All right, and we call that static equilibrium. All right, so static equilibrium is due to linear acceleration. So what does linear mean? How many different ways can you move in a linear direction? You can move forwards, backwards, right and left, maybe up and down. Okay, as long as you're going in a straight line, that's linear. And acceleration means, like, not when you're going at constant velocity, but when you're changing your speed. For instance, when you're stopped to when you start moving, or if you're moving at a constant velocity and then all of a sudden you stop, that's deceleration. That's just another form of acceleration. And gravity acts like acceleration to you. All right, so right now I'm standing on my feet and I feel pressure. Guess where I feel pressure? Do I feel it on my back? Top of my head? Where do I feel pressure? On my feet, the soles of my feet. All right, so what is that like? If you're sitting in a car and you're holding onto the steering wheel and all of a sudden your back feels pressure, what's happening to you? If your back feels pressure, when does your head snap backwards? When you step on the gas and the car moves forward. Okay, your head goes back. When you step on the brakes, what happens? Your head goes forward, right? So you'd feel pressure maybe on your sternum or something if you were to hit the steering wheel. So that's acceleration and deceleration. So what I'm trying to tell you is right now, you're being like what? Accelerated upward, because that's where you feel the pressure. You feel the pressure on your feet when you're standing. So gravity produces an acceleration. Even though you're not moving, that's what gravity does. It's pulling on you all the time. So there are two places that can feel that acceleration. And they are what we call maculae. And there are two maculae inside the vestibule. You have the saccule and the utricle. These are both maculae. And where do you have those? You've got them here and here, right? So let's look and see what they actually look like. Okay. They are right here. So this is, so here we see some sensory neurons that are going to send action potentials to the brain. These neurons are associated with these receptor cells. And so here is a receptor cell, and it has these cilia that are poking up in your ear up into this jello-like material. We call that a gelatinous mass. And on top of that gelatinous mass, we have crystals, and these crystals are called otoliths. Anytime you hear that word odo, guess what sense or part of the body you should automatically think of? That should be the ear, right? Like an otoscope is an instrument somebody would use to look inside your ear, as opposed to, what's the name of that instrument that somebody would use to look inside your eyes called? It's not an otoscope, that's called an ophthalmoscope. You know, if you ever had anybody look inside your eyes, that's an ophthalmoscope. So odo refers to the ear. All right, so when somebody's head is upright like this, right, gravity is pulling which way? It's pulling straight down. So it's pulling this gelatinous material straight down, and it's not bending these cilia. These cilia right here we call stereocilia. All right, the otoliths act as weights that push down on the gelatinous mass. All right, but now let's have this person tilt their head forward. Guess what happens to the maculae? Now they shift position, so now they're in a vertical position. And the gelatin now starts to get pulled down by gravity, especially because of those crystals, little tiny crystals made out of calcium carbonate, pull down on the gelatin. And look what happens to the stereocilia. They start to bend. All right, and when they bend, there are proteins in the membrane that open up sodium channels just by deforming the cilia. So when a sodium channel opens, what happens to these cells right here? What happens to a cell that all of a sudden sodium can enter? What happens to the electrical properties of that cell? What does it do? Yeah, it just depolarizes. You're familiar with that. Okay, and if the person was to bend their head backwards the other way, the cilia would bend the other way, and the channels would close, which means that the cell then would stop depolarizing or hyperpolarize. So depending on head position, these cells either depolarize or hyperpolarize depending on what the position of that person's head is, because that's what gravity is doing. Gravity is always pulling down. All right, so guess what the name of these cells are right here? Because they have these like little hairs sticking out of them, these are hair cells as well. Where did we run into hair cells just a couple minutes ago? In the organ of Corti in particular, which is inside the cochlea. Okay, so what do these hair cells look like? These are what the hair cells look like. Here's a hair cell. There are some stereocilia, just projections from this apical surface. These are sticking up into that gelatin-like material. And this big one right here is called the kinocilium. As the stereocilia pull away from the kinocilium, that inhibits the formation of action potentials. But as they move toward the kinocilium, that stimulates action potentials. These then go to the brain. So which one signals a higher intensity? It is this one right here. Okay? And the lower intensity will be in this direction. So your brain can interpret this change in action potentials as a change in head position. All right, but this is only for linear acceleration, a change of motion in one direction. Okay, so where does that take place? That takes place in the vestibule, and the vestibule contains these organs, the maculae, which you have two, you have the utricle and saccule, right? The organs that contain hair cells that send action potentials to the brain. That gives you the sense of head position. All right, the last area that we're going to look at, and that is the semicircular canals. You have three semicircular canals. So remember that there were three dimensions in space that you could move in, right? There's forwards and backwards, or anterior, posterior, left, right, up and down, superior, inferior. And what the semicircular canals do is it doesn't tell you how you're accelerating in a linear direction, but how you're changing in terms of what we call angular acceleration. Angular acceleration. So what is angular acceleration? And you have all experienced this probably when you were 4 years old, maybe 3 years old. Okay, and maybe even last weekend, I'm not sure. You would stand still, all right, and then you start spinning around, okay, with your eyes closed. Ooh, I shouldn't do that. And then you stop with your eyes open, and what happens? What sensation do you hear? The world is like spinning, and you have this sense of disequilibrium, right? You have altered consciousness, basically, without drugs when you do that. Okay, now why does that happen? That is due to the sense of kinetic equilibrium, right? So when we say angular acceleration, what is your body really experiencing? When you say angular, it means something is turning. What's a nice way of saying turning? What are you doing when you're doing that? You're spinning, right? So angular acceleration is just a fancy word for spinning. So the semicircular canals give you the sense of spinning, and it helps adjust your body for whenever you do some kind of spinning kind of motion, which we don't do all that often. All right, but whenever you turn your head a little bit, all right, your semicircular canals monitor that motion and send information to your cerebellum and muscles so that you don't fall down, even with a slight rotation of your head. Okay, so how does that go about? Well, notice that there's a bulge at the base of each of these three semicircular canals. And so these three semicircular canals can monitor spinning, right, in a left to right kind of spin, or an anterior posterior or a superior inferior kind of spinning motion. So that's why you have three of them. So each of the three dimensions that determine space. And inside the semicircular canals, there is fluid, which we call endolymph. And that endolymph, like all property of matter, has inertia. So what the heck does inertia mean? I have to do a little demonstration. Okay, so what is inertia? Inertia is a property of matter, okay, and matter, if it is in motion, it likes to stay in motion, unless there's a force that's acting on it to bounce it out of the way. Another property of matter, and this has to do with inertia, is that if something is stationary, it likes to remain stationary. It will resist the tendency to move. Okay, so that's inertia. Inertia means if something's stationary, it doesn't want to move, but if it is moving, it wants to stay moving in whatever direction it's moving at. All right, so I need to give you a demonstration. So for instance, here is, and you could do this in a couple of weeks when a lot of people come over for Thanksgiving or something, and your table is set with wine glasses and candles and water glasses and a tray of turkey and all that kind of stuff, right? And there's a tablecloth underneath it, and you can say, hey everybody, let me show you what we learned in physiology class. Okay, I'm going to show you an example of inertia. And that is, okay, inertia is if something's stationary, what does it want to do? Stay stationary. So if I move the tablecloth out of the way, all the wine glasses and every plate and everything are going to stay in the same place, right? Is that right? Or am I wrong? No problem. Okay, so everything, so do that, and nothing will spill when you do this. Okay, so that's a property of inertia. The other property is what? If something is in motion and you stop it, guess what? It's going to want to continue. So let's start moving the water bottle and then stop it. Ooh, did you see it move when I stopped? It still wanted to keep moving. That's inertia. Should I do that again? We'll get it moving and then stop it. And it kept moving. That's inertia. So the water in this bottle corresponds to the water or the endolymph inside the semicircular canals. Maybe I'll hold this until we're done with the slides. Or I might get thirsty, one or the other. Okay. All right, so let's look at, okay, the organs inside the semicircular canals, and in particular, these are inside the ampulla, these little swellings. Ampulla just means a little vial of something. And the organ that's in the ampulla right here is called the crista ampullaris. Okay, so we're going to talk, and so there's a crista ampullaris in each of these three different ampulla. That's the organ that gives you the sense of kinetic equilibrium. And here it is right here. So it's just a little bump, and there are receptor cells and support cells in this epithelium. The receptor cells have these hairs sticking out of them, or stereocilia. So guess what the name of these hairs, these cells are? They're hair cells, okay? The hairs, or the stereocilia, are poking up into this, another gelatinous kind of mass, right? It's a gelatin substance that can deform pretty easily, right? And don't forget, these are in the semicircular canals. So here is somebody stationary, and then all of a sudden, he starts twisting or rotating, right? Which is producing some kind of angular acceleration. So the crista ampullaris, which is made of the gelatinous mass, which is what we call the cochlea, or the cupula, is a gelatinous mass, and the crista down over here. So when somebody starts spinning, this part is attached to your head. So as soon as your head moves, guess what happens to the crista ampullaris? It moves as well, because it's just attached to your head. But now, what about the fluid inside the semicircular canals? Right, that fluid, when you start moving, is going to want to do what? Just stay stationary. But if the crista ampullaris is moving, right, then that even because the crista ampullaris is moving, the fluid is stationary, then the fluid pushes on the crista ampullaris, bending the stereocilia, which opens sodium channels, which does what to the hair cells? It depolarizes them. Okay? And that sends signals to the brain, which you interpret as accelerating in what a spinning kind of motion in one direction or the other. All right. Well, now let's just say that this guy right here has been spinning for a half hour with his eyes closed. What can you tell me about the endolymph? After a long period of time, what happens to the endolymph? It catches up with the spinning of your body, right? It catches up. And then he stops all of a sudden. What happens to the endolymph? It keeps moving. And so what happens? It pushes the cupula back in the opposite direction because the endolymph is now spinning, but the crista ampullaris is stopped because the guy stopped. And when he opens up his eyes, what does he see? He sees the world spinning in the opposite direction because his endolymph is pushing on these hair cells in the opposite direction, and that sense will persist until the endolymph catches up with the rest of his body, which is not really long, is what, a couple seconds or something like that. Okay. So that's what gives us the sense of angular acceleration, because why is it that that endolymph can move through a semicircular canal? Right? Because it's a nice circle. It can just flow in a circle depending on what direction you're spinning in. And as that endolymph is spinning in one direction, it's going to push on the cochlea, and that's going to cause depolarization in those hair cells, sending action potentials to the brain, and you have information that you can use to maintain your equilibrium as a result of that. Okay. So I think that's all I'm going to say about hearing. I think that's all we have to say about hearing. Except, let's make a little table just to make sure that you have it all straight in your mind. I'll erase the piano. But if you want to use an example like a harpsichord, no, not a harpsichord, a harp, okay, that would work fine for the cochlea. So the first thing that you have to know in terms of the ear, oh, that's too bad. Erased a really good figure. What are the senses? What senses involve your ear? Hearing, number one. Equilibrium. What are the two equilibrium? Static equilibrium and kinetic equilibrium. Sometimes we call that dynamic. So let's just say hearing, static, EQ, and kinetic equilibrium. All right, so for hearing, what parts of the ear do you need? What are the parts? We got external, middle, inner. So for hearing, what parts of the ear do you need? You need the external, middle, and inner. What about for static equilibrium? Is there anything from the outside world that needs to get into the vestibule for you to have the sense of acceleration? Nope. So you don't need external, don't need middle, but you do need inner ear. What about for kinetic equilibrium? Same thing, right? You don't need anything in the external ear, middle ear, but you do need stuff in the inner ear. All right, so let's talk about that stuff right now. What about the bony labyrinth? What bony labyrinth is responsible for hearing? Cochlea. What's the bony labyrinth for static equilibrium? Starts with a V. Vestibule. And the bony labyrinth for kinetic are those circular things. Yeah, semicircular canals. All right, so what else is important here? Bony labyrinth. How about the organ? The organ responsible for transducing these physical phenomena into action potentials. What's the organ? So that organ for hearing has got to be inside the cochlea. What's inside the cochlea that allows you to hear? Organ of Corti. Organ of Corti. What about for static equilibrium? That's in the vestibule. What do we call those? They're both, yeah. I heard this right. The maculae, and there's two of them. Yeah, the utricle and the saccule. Okay, they're both maculae. And what about for angular acceleration? What's the organ that senses angular acceleration called? It's two words. Two words. It's found in the ampulla, that little bulge at the base of a semicircular canal. It's called the crista ampullaris. All right, so this is just kind of like an abbreviated little form right here because you should know what the organ of Corti looks like, right? And you should know what a macula looks like. What's kind of strange about the macula? What does it have that's an important weight? You don't have many of these in different parts of your body. You really only have them here. The little weights that make up the otoliths, those little crystals. The little crystals inside your ear that pull on the gelatinous mass. These are in the maculae. Okay? And you should have an idea of what the crista ampullaris looks like. It's that little bulge with hair cells sticking up into the cupula. Okay, so I have a picture of what these look like in your mind. But this is just a nice organizational map. Now, what about the receptor cell? So we got the major part of the ear, the bony labyrinth, the organ, and now the receptor cell. What's the receptor cell, the particular cell necessary for hearing? No, not the hair cell. How could it be a hair cell? Well, because it's got little hairs sticking out of it. So you're right, it is a hair cell. Okay? But it just sounds weird. Right? Hair cell. Because it has those stereocilia that are poking up to the tectorial membrane, so in the tectorial membranes that sends action potentials to the brain. Okay? It's not like hair on our head, but still it's a hair cell. What about the receptor cell for static equilibrium? Now you're really kidding me. Is it a hair cell? Again? The same cell? As a matter of fact, yeah, you're right. It's a hair cell. It's a hair cell. And there's nothing similar between hearing and static equilibrium, but it's using what? Almost exactly the same cell. It's just been applied differently in your body to give you totally different kinds of sensations. All right, what about kinetic equilibrium? What's the receptor cell called? And you are right, once again, it's a hair cell as well. And it's just been incorporated into a different kind of organ that gives you a totally different perception of your world, right? These cells are all the same, they're just applied differently. Okay, they're all just hair cells. All right, so this is probably a pretty good table for you to memorize and become familiar with. Okay, so it is hair cell for all of those. That's I think, kind of funny. Yeah. Yeah, it's whenever those stereocilia bend, and that changes the conformation of sodium channels in the membrane of those stereocilia. So they can open or close, and so they'll depolarize more or less. If they depolarize less, you could think of that as hyperpolarization, okay? Yeah. Okay. So we have one more special sense to talk about, and that's vision. All right, question? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, your book has a good picture, but I don't have that picture. All right, so this part right here, that's the end of the coil. That's what we call the helicotrema. That's the far end. That's the end that's farthest away from the oval window right here. This is the thickest part. That's the widest part of the cochlea. And since it's the widest part, that's the one that vibrates the slowest. That's corresponding to a really long string inside of a piano. And the thinnest part of the cochlea is down over in this region over here. So that's the part that vibrates at a high frequency. So the hair cells in that region send information to the high frequency center in the brain, the temporal lobe. Okay, and so when you perceive sound, it's not because of these hair cells depolarizing. Why is it that you perceive sound? What's happening in your body? What part of your body is giving you the perception of sound? Yeah, it's going to be the depolarizations in the cerebral cortex, namely the temporal lobes, right? And so in your temporal lobes, you actually have like an arrangement of a piano as well on either side. And if one area gets action potentials, you hear a particular tone, and if it moves one way or the other, it's going to seem like a higher frequency or a lower frequency. Okay? And if three regions in the temporal lobe have action potentials, what is your perception going to be? Three different frequencies. It's going to give you the perception, for instance, of a chord, because if you put different frequencies together, you'll hear, for instance, a chord. Okay. So sound is a mechanical wave that's going through air, which is a medium, or it can actually travel underwater. That's a nice medium. It's a physical pressure wave. Light, on the other hand, right, is not a physical wave. It's an electromagnetic wave. And there are other kinds of electromagnetic waves that you're sort of familiar with already, like you've heard of microwaves. What do we do with microwaves? We could heat food up with them, for instance. Yeah, popcorn. All right, so it just so happens that these frequencies and microwaves can be absorbed by certain kinds of molecules, and when it absorbs that energy, they become very, very hot. And then there are radio waves. These are even lower in energy, but we can transmit information using radio waves and technology. Then we have infrared, which you can't see, but that gives you the perception. If that's shown on your body, you can feel temperature with that because it heats your body up, even though you can't see it. These are the wavelengths right here that we can actually see with our eyes. All right, and this wavelength is just the measure. So here's a wave. Does that look like a wave? Pretty good. Okay, the wavelength is just the measurement from one peak to another peak. That's the wavelength right there. Okay, and we see the wavelength in nanometers, which is what, a really small distance. That's 10 to the minus 9th meters. A meter is this big. If we chop it up into 10 to the 9th pieces, that would be a nanometer. So it's pretty high frequency. And this is what we call the visible light spectrum. These all correspond to different energies, but our eye perceives these different energies as what? As color. So what's another name for a visible light spectrum? You could call that a rainbow, for instance, right? Now you've probably all seen rainbows because all of these different frequencies or waves are emitted by the sun, but these are just the ones that we can see. Ultraviolet is damaging, for instance, to your skin. What do you have in your skin to help protect your skin from ultraviolet electromagnetic radiation? You have melanin, right? That's produced by melanocytes. X-rays, right? You can't see either. These are very high frequencies, high energy, and then gamma rays. These are even higher in energy. These can go right through your body, except bones can stop them, right? Well, X-rays, bones can stop X-rays, so you can use X-rays to take pictures of bones because it goes through soft tissue, but bones will stop them. All right, so for instance, if you want to know, for instance, the colors of the rainbow, you've probably heard of this guy, Roy G. Biv. All right, so that just tells you what colors belong to each other, next to each other in a rainbow. So even though I can't see colors at all, I could say, well, you know what? I don't know which one is red. Let's say red over here. Okay, so red, and then orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet, right? That just corresponds to this guy's name right here. So even though I had no idea what I was saying, you can I can't point to it. You can just use this little acronym to find out what colors belong to each other. And what these are different energy levels. All right, so you have certain cells in your body that are sensitive to some particular range of energies of electromagnetic radiation. So what do we call those cells that can absorb this energy, this electromagnetic radiation? What kind of cells are those? That's a kind of exteroreceptor. And where do you have these cells? Obviously you have them in your eyes, right? And what part of your eye has them? What layer? Yeah, the retina has these photoreceptor cells. So we're going to look at some photoreceptor cells. Okay, some can respond to red, some to green, some to blue. Okay. All right, but besides the photoreceptor cells, you have what we call accessory structures in the eyes. And you've learned a bunch of accessory structures in anatomy, like extrinsic eye muscles, eyelashes, eyebrows, and things of that nature. Okay, so here are some others. You have an iris, right? So the iris is the deeply pigmented part of the eye that we can see. It's not the white part. What's the white part of the eye called? It's a layer. That's a sclera, right? Okay. All right, so here's the sclera right here. Here is the iris, and notice that the iris has two different kinds of muscle. Do you think these are skeletal muscle or smooth muscle? Not cardiac muscle, right? For sure not cardiac muscle. And not skeletal muscle because you can't voluntarily control these. You can't make your pupils get really small or really, really big voluntarily. It controls itself depending on the amount of light that is surrounding you. All right, so for instance, in very dim light, which we signify right here, guess what size the pupil should be? The pupil should be large or small? It should be large to let a lot of light in so that you can see what's going on. All right, so don't forget this pupil right here, which kind of looks like dark blue to me or something. I don't know what it looks like to you, but that's the pupil. Don't forget the pupil is not really a structure. The pupil is really just a hole in what structure? The pupil is just a hole in the iris. Right, it's just a hole in the iris. So the iris has circular smooth muscle, which we see right here, right around the pupil, and there are radial arranged fibers, and these are controlled by two different parts of the autonomic nervous system. The radial part is, that's this one over here. Here's the radial part. These muscles right here are controlled by the sympathetic nervous system. So when sympathetic nerves go to the iris, they release norepinephrine, cause the radial muscles to contract, and so that's going to pull, opening up the pupil. So under dim light conditions, right, that is from the sympathetic innervation of the eye. But under bright light conditions, right, you have the parasympathetic nerves going to the circularly arranged muscles of the pupil, and that's going to release acetylcholine. There's muscarinic receptors on these fibers right here. That's going to cause that muscle to constrict the pupil, causing pupil constriction. Okay, so parasympathetic causes constriction, sympathetic causes dilation. And then, of course, you should know which muscle is responsible for each of those. The radial is for dilation, the circular for constriction. And I think probably that should sort of make sense, because when you're presented with a stressful, potentially harmful situation, what nervous system is working? Is it the sympathetic or parasympathetic that is most dominant? Sympathetic, right? And when you're presented with a stressful situation, do you think you should let more light in to see what's going around, or should your pupil constrict, hardly letting any light in, so that you can't see what's going on? your pupils actually get very big when you're presented with a stressful situation stimulated by the sympathetic nervous system. So this is the sympathetic stimulation here. This is parasympathetic stimulation. And when you combine both together, that gives you nice antagonistic and perfect control over the diameter of your pupil, and it's very important to protect your retina by just letting the right amount of light in. Okay. All right, so that's one accessory structure, the iris. Another accessory structure has to do with accommodation. And what the heck does accommodation mean? Well, when you look at the world, you can really only focus on one distance away from your body at a time. So if you take your hand and put it in front of your face like this and focus on your fingertip, all right, go ahead and do that. Your fingertip should be in focus, but what about the rest of the room? Oh, geez, I have like 300 students all of a sudden. Right? Everything's blurry. You see multiple images, so you can focus on your fingertip. All right, now keep your finger there and look at the rest of the room. What does your fingertip look like? It's all blurry, right? So you can only focus on one depth at a time. Not everything is in focus, depending on what your attention is placed on. That's what we call, what sense is that? We call that accommodation, right? That's accommodation. All right, so what has to change in your eye in order for you to accommodate? Well, there's a structure right here that you're familiar with. That's the lens, right? And the lens is behind the iris. And the lens can be really thin if the suspensory ligaments are pulling on it. So here are the suspensory ligaments here and here. And in the second edition, I can see some suspensory ligaments here and here. All right. So the lens gets really thin when there's no tension on the suspensory ligaments, and the lens changes shape. It gets really thick when the tension is released. So there is a muscle that pulls on these suspensory ligaments, and that's called the ciliary muscle or the ciliary body. It's a circular, smooth muscle. Okay, and when that circular, smooth muscle relaxes, right? Guess what happens to the diameter of the ciliary muscle when it relaxes? When it relaxes, does it get smaller or does it get bigger when it relaxes? Okay, when the ciliary body relaxes, the circle gets actually bigger. Okay, and when it contracts, it shrinks down. Okay, so this is a little strange. So as the circle gets bigger, guess what happens to the tension, of the suspensory ligaments that are attached to the lens? As the muscle relaxes and stretches out, guess what happens to the tension on those suspensory ligaments? As the ciliary muscle gets bigger and bigger and bigger, it's doing what? It's pulling more and more and more, which is the opposite way that we usually think of muscles. Usually we think muscles will pull on a tendon when it what does what? When it contracts. But it's the opposite for the eye. Okay, so when the muscle relaxes, that's when tension is applied to the suspensory ligaments. And that's when the lens gets long but thin. It changes the curvature. And when the ciliary body right here contracts, right, the circle gets smaller. That releases the tension in the suspensory ligaments, and that allows the lens to get thick, just like this. So you can inherently focus on two different depths depending on the curvature of the lens over here, which is what we call accommodation. Okay, so when the lens is thin, this is good for distant vision. When the lens has more curvature, for instance, when it's thick and highly curved, this is for close vision. So guess what happens as we get older to this lens right here? Okay, well, yeah, it deteriorates, but how, in which way? It can actually become opaque, but that's not really what we're talking about right now, right? It just gets stiffer, so it doesn't like to change as much, and when it does change, it takes a longer time for that to happen, right? So, for instance, if you see somebody that's 70 years old driving on the 405 freeway, what speed are they traveling at? Okay, like maybe what? 20 miles an hour, maybe 15 miles an hour. But why is that? Okay? Well, yeah, because their vision is so poor. So when you're in that age group, what is one thing for sure you don't want to do? Yeah, you don't want to drive, but I mean, still a lot of people do like to drive. They don't want to get a speeding ticket, right? Because if you get a speeding ticket, what happens to your license? Well, it gets yanked, right? And you might not ever get it back. So what are you doing when you're driving on the freeway when you're in that age group? What are you looking at? Your speedometer, because you don't want to get a speeding ticket. Where's your speedometer? Is that far away or is that close to you? That's close. So you're looking at the speedometer and you go, oh, I'm going 20 miles an hour. That's great. I'm not going to get a speeding ticket, right? Okay. Huh? Well, they can sort of see it. All right. But so now you're relieved. You're not getting a speeding ticket. But now what else are you worried about? The last place you really want to be is on the 405. You're worried about missing your exit. So what do you have to do? You got to look up from the dashboard, which is close, out the windshield. All right. And what do you see? You know what? It's just all blurry. Because where have you accommodated? You've accommodated for close up. So you look out the front windshield and 1001, 1002, you don't see anything. And then all of a sudden things pop into focus, right? Because that lens is stiff. It takes a while for it to get what? To get pulled thin again, all right? And then so then the person driving sees, oh, I haven't missed the exit. It's still a half a mile away. So they feel relieved. But then what happens? Yeah, they're worried about, oh, geez, I might be speeding now. So they look from down the street to at the dashboard, and what do you see? Nothing. It's all blurry because it takes time to accommodate because that lens is stiff. So 1001, 1002, 1003, the dashboard, the speedometer, you can see again, and you can see, oh, I'm only going 25 miles an hour. That's great, right? I'm not speeding. Not going to get any speeding ticket. But then what happens? Well, yeah, you're worried about your exit again. So you look out the window, and what do you see? Nothing. It's all blurry. 1001, 1002. Ah, I didn't miss the exit yet. Then what happens? Am I speeding? Then you look at the dashboard again, and you can't see it. Okay? So, anyway, so what I'm trying to relate to you, yeah, it sucks, but when you see those viejitos driving on the freeway, just be really kind to them because they can't see where they're going, right? They look at the dashboard or look down. It just takes time for them to figure out what they're doing. They don't want to miss their exit. They don't want to get a speeding ticket. Okay, so what is that all about? That's accommodation to stretching this lens out or making it thick or making it thin so that you can focus at different distances from your eyes. Okay. Now don't forget, when the muscle relaxes, that's when tension is applied to the suspensory ligament. When the muscle contracts, that releases the tension on the suspensory ligament. So it's kind of the opposite that what you're really used to. But I think if you look at it, all right, it will make sense to you. When the muscle relaxes, the diameter gets bigger, pulling on the suspensory ligaments. When the muscle contracts, the diameter of the circular muscle decreases, releasing the tension. Okay, that's accommodation. All right, so in terms of visual acuity, that's just the sharpness of vision. That just tells us the resolving power of how our eyes are operating, which tells us how small an object you can really perceive. Right, the detail within an object is the resolving power. And in order to have good resolving power, things have to be in focus. So if there is an image out in the world, the light rays from that image have to be focused on one point on our retina. If they're not focused at this point, then it will look blurry. Just like it used to be if you had a camera, what did you have to do with a camera? It was before your time. You had to turn the lens around and focus it so that it would adjust the lenses in the camera in order to get the image in focus. It was actually hard to do. It's done automatically now. And so if somebody has vision to where when they look at something, the image is focused on the retina on the back of the eye, that's what we call normal vision. Then we call that emmetropia. No correction is necessary for that. But for instance, not all of our eyeballs are perfectly round or the right shape or the right length for light to focus right on the retina. For instance, if somebody's eyes are way too long, so the retina is way back over here, all right, if they still have a normal cornea and retina, the light is going to focus at this location, which is where? In front of the retina, and by the time it reaches the retina, it is now out of focus, so they're going to have blurry vision. We call that myopia or nearsightedness. And in order to correct that, we take a concave lens and we spread the light rays out, we separate them, so now when it goes through the cornea and the lens, it focuses at the right location. Okay, so that is nearsightedness or myopia. Hyperopia, on the other hand, is when somebody's eyeball is too short, so that light is actually focusing behind the eye, behind the retina, and you need a convex lens to start bending it before it gets into the eye so that it focuses right on the retina. All right, so that's hyperopia, this is myopia. So this is nearsightedness versus farsightedness. So we all have some kinds of conditions of this. Now, as you age, right, the shape of your head changes, the shape of your eye changes. So what can you tell me about your vision? Guess what happens to it over your lifetime? It changes. And usually we're still in fairly young population, and in young population your vision usually gets worse, but it's not uncommon as you get older for your vision actually to improve. Okay, as the shape of your eye changes, okay, it might actually improve, and you might not have to wear glasses as you get older. Okay, well, there are two parts to the eye that can bend light. Let's look at this right here. All right, so in order to bend light, you have to have something that's curved inside the eye. And does this lens look curved to you? The surface, is that flat or is that curved? That's curved, right? So that can bend light, that can help focus light on the retina. All right, but that the lens is not the most important structure of the eye for focusing or bending light. There's another structure of the eye that's even more important. Can you see another structure that has curvature? What is that thing called? What is that thing called right there? That is the cornea, right? And the cornea is not flat, it's curved. And the cornea actually has more power in focusing light on your retina than your lens does. What's your lens most responsible for? We call that accommodation, right? But for plain focusing, the cornea is actually the most important thing. So when, for instance, when somebody has really terrible vision, it can be corrected with a laser procedure called LASIK. And that's a surgical procedure that adjusts the curvature of the cornea right here. It doesn't adjust the curvature of the lens. That would be more difficult because where's the lens? It's pretty deep inside the eye. But where's the cornea? It's right here on the surface. That's easy to get to. All right, so there's an ophthalmologist that can measure the shape of the cornea, can measure the shape of the retina, and figure out how they have to match up so that you have nice, perfect vision, so that things focus right on the retina. And they can change the shape of the cornea by blasting away a few cells or layers of cells on the cornea to change its shape by burning the cornea, which is relatively painless because they actually take away the epithelium off of the surface of the cornea and then put it back after they change it. And you can get really nice, almost perfect vision without the need for wearing glasses after that. Okay. So that's why that LASIK procedure is so important. But more importantly in this class, what are the two structures that have curvature that produce emmetropia? What are the two structures in the eye that really focus light on the retina? The first structure we talked about was the lens. The second structure is the cornea. Notice the nice curvature of the cornea right here, right? So the cornea plays even probably a more important role in focusing than the lens does. Okay. Now, astigmatism is due to an asymmetric curvature, which I don't think I see on these slides right here. It could be an acurvature in the cornea, or an asymmetrical curvature of the cornea, or of the lens itself. so that when you look at an object, for instance, maybe the top part of the image looks like in focus, but the bottom part is not in focus. And then you need an aspherical lens like this one to focus all the light on the retina, no matter where it's coming from, whether it's the top of the image or the bottom of the image. And the same thing from right to left as well, which we don't see on this particular slide. Okay, that's astigmatism. And I've heard that that can even be corrected now with LASIK procedures. Okay, though I don't recommend doing it for cosmetic reasons. And we don't have time really to talk about that in the class. But if you're interested, I can talk about it a little bit sometime. Okay, so let's talk about how light energy is transduced into action potentials. Because what does the occipital lobe understand? It only understands action potentials. That's the language of the cerebral cortex, right? Okay, so by changing the frequency of action potentials, changes the intensity of the light, and where it goes in the occipital lobe tells us what color it is. All right, only action potentials. So you have two kinds of photoreceptor cells in the retina. You have some that kind of look like rods, and you have others that kind of look like cones. So we call those rod and cone cells. All right, and actually the cone cells are much smaller than this diagram. They're smaller than the rods right here. That's a little bit of a misrepresentation in this drawing. But these photoreceptor cells are deep inside the retina. So here is this is the posterior chamber of the eye filled with vitreous humor. Right, and then here is the retina, then here is the choroid layer. So these photoreceptor cells are a lot closer to the choroid than they are the vitreous humor. So light actually has to pass through all of these neurons to get to the photoreceptor cells. All right, so what's the job of the choroid right here? Can you remember that from anatomy? It contains blood vessels that nourishes the retina. Do you see any blood vessels in the retina? No, there are no blood vessels in the retina. And if there were, guess what would happen to these photoreceptor cells? They'd get pushed out of the way. But what do you need to see? Do you need a blood vessel to see something? Nope, because you've got blood vessels all over your body. You need photoreceptor cells. So if there are blood vessels growing in the retina, that produces blindness. So you don't want blood vessels growing in the retina. And that can happen during retinopathy is just some kind of pathology of the retina. So retinopathy of prematurity, for instance, if there's a baby that's born prematurely and they're placed in an incubator which has a high concentration of oxygen because their lungs aren't developed, all right, that oxygen can actually diffuse through the cornea into the posterior chamber of the eye and stimulate the growth of blood vessels in the retina. Okay, and we didn't know this for a long period of time. And there are a lot of newborns that develop blindness because incubators promoted the development of blood vessels in the retina. So where do those blood vessels belong? In the choroid right here. And then the sclera, of course, is just mostly connective tissue. Okay. So what are the kinds of cells that we have in the retina, the neuronal cells? Well, we got the photoreceptor, rods and cones. We've got some horizontal cells. Oh, here, look at this nice bipolar cell. We didn't see many places where we have bipolar cells, but for special senses, we have some. Amacrine and then ganglion cells are the nerve cells that take action potentials all the way to the occipital lobe, or actually to the thalamus, for instance, on its way to the occipital lobe. So the rod cells and cone cells are sensitive to different kinds of light. Rod cells are sensitive to very dim light, but it only gives you the perception of gray or black and white. So you can see things in shades of gray, black, and white. The cone cells, you can actually see colors with. So these are cells that are sensitive to color. The trade-off is that you need very bright light in order to see color, because these cells are very small. The cone cells are very, very small, but that also means since the cone cells are small, you can see the smallest objects with them. And when you can see a small object, that increases your resolution, that increases your ability to see fine detail. So cones allow you to see fine detail in color. The disadvantage is that you need bright light in order for that to happen. The cone cells are big. You don't need the same kind of light intensity. You can see in dim light with a cone cell, but what is the world going to look like in dim light? It's going to look black and white, right? And it's going to look a little bit blurry as well, right? You won't see the same kind of detail. Green and red, yeah. I can see yellow. I could probably see yellow better than everybody here in the room. But red and green I can't see. So there are many colors that have red in them. For instance, like pink is blue with red in it. I don't know if that makes sense to you, but from what I understand, that's true. Okay. So if you take a pink flower, which has a little red in it, that flower looks blue to me. So if you take a pink flower and hold it up against a blue sky, it kind of just disappears. It has the same color to it. Yeah. So my cones are screwed up. So it's a genetic, it's an inherited abnormality. I wouldn't call it a disease process, but it's an abnormality because there aren't many people that are colorblind. But a lot of men are. There's 8% of men are. But, you know, who really cares if there's a guy that's colorblind? It really doesn't matter. Okay, so I'm okay. But, so it doesn't matter much day in and day out, except when you're driving, it matters. Because what are the control signals at a stop, at an intersection? Red and green, the two colors that I can't see. So think of that. See if my car's in the parking lot before you drive home tonight. You might not want to share the streets with me. No, it's really easy to get a driver's license. They make you do a colorblind test, but they show you a diagram that looks like this. And they say, oh, what color is that? And I just say, oh, well, that's green. And they go, what color is that? And I go, well, that's yellow. And they say, what color is that? And I say, well, that one's red. And they go, oh, well, okay, you're not colorblind. So I don't know, you know, I have no idea who makes these tests up, but it's not very difficult to pass the tests. During the day, I can't see a red light at all. It's not bright enough for me to see. So if I'm driving during the day and I see a control signal that's this rectangular thing over an intersection and nothing's lit up, then I know what? I know it's a red light. Okay, so that's pretty easy. And the green light down over here always looks white. So if I see a white light, I know it's green. And the yellow I can see no problem. Okay. The trouble is at night, sometimes when you're driving, we'll have to start here next time, but if I'm driving out in the at an intersection someplace, way out in the boonies, they only have one light that flashes. Okay, if I don't see any light during the day, I know it's a red light, so I stop. But at night, the yellow light and the red light look the same, so I can't tell. So if I'm out in the boonies at an intersection, okay, yeah, I got to really watch how other traffic is going, or I stop, but you really have to be careful because if you stop for a yellow light and the guy behind you obviously sees that it's not red, it's yellow, right, you could get creamed. So I do have to be careful if there's only just one light, especially if I'm on a motorcycle. And then I would assume it's red, but then everybody's supposed to stop anyway. Okay, yeah. Not anymore. I usually just drive a car. It's just too dangerous in LA for a motorcycle. Okay. All right, so let's start on 76 next time.